It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had the life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, not one, but two guests from my former practice space roommates, my buddies, Alex Edkins and Hayden Menzies from the great band Metz, who are continuing their undefeated streak with a fantastic new record up on Gravity Hill. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire. How extraordinary is Tristan as a guest booker? Well, I've been trying to get Alex and Hayden on the show for years and just have fudged it up at every turn. Here's Tristan coming through. It happens in a matter of weeks. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show. You can send the message to Tristan, and the message will get to me. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. There's an Instagram page, a Facebook page, a TikTok page, a YouTube page, all for this podcast. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast. You can check out the band I play in over at fuckedup.cc. We got a bunch of new records that are out. We're also on all those social media platforms at fuckedup on those things. We have new records, tour dates to get announced soon, I think. Lots more stuff, so check out the band. And that is it. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, Alex and Hayden are here on the podcast. Finally, this has taken years.
As you see in the feed, or you may have noticed in the feed, I reposted Chris Slorak, the third member of the Mets triumvirate, his first appearance on the podcast from way back when in 2015, episode 27. And I've been planning on having these guys on since then. Chris has even come back twice, at least once since then, maybe twice. And I still didn't have Hayden or Alex on, but once again, thanks to Tristan. Now it has happened. Check out this fantastic new record up on Gravity Hill, out on the venerable Sub Pop Records that Mets has just dropped. It's a little bit different sounding, but still fantastic. This band has never done anything really wrong in their entire run. They're one of those bands. Very much reliable on. Very cool people, too. I was stoked to get a chance to talk to them. I've been a fan of Hayden in bands since we were both little kids, as you'll hear on the show. And I'm not going to ramble on anymore. In terms of notes, the London Warped Tour that I talk about was actually, I think, in Mossport. It was not in London at all. The year after was in London. That'll make sense when you hear it. Thank you to Elliot for giving me those tapes. I say some guy. It's my buddy Elliot. So thank you, Elliot, for the tapes. And finally, when I say my basement's smelly, it's not smelly because of like food garbage or like weird shit. It's smelly because of weed. Anyway, that's for my own pride. I had to put that in. All right, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Alex and Hayden from Mets on Turned Out a Punk. Are you guys ready to go?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it.
Hayden, Alex, this is finally happening.
Finally.
Yes.
Well, it's been like, I want to have both of you on for a very long time. I've talked to both of you about doing it. But anytime I have to book something, it never, you see the chaos I live in right now. I think this probably explains why shit takes so long with me. But now, because Tristan got involved, here we are in my house. Welcome to the chaos and the filth.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Well, I feel like this is going to be, like, I've known your bandmate who's been on the show several times now for years and years, and we grew up together, but you guys have, like, a completely different experience, and I was talking to Tristan about the show, and he's like, yeah, this would be awesome, come over, and I'm like, yeah, I can talk to Hayden about Three Penny Opera, and he's like, what do you mean Three Penny Opera? I'm like, he was the drummer in Three Penny Opera. Tristan's like, no, they just had some little kid. And I'm like, the little kid grew up.
In some ways, yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, guys. I guess, like, unless you guys have a way that you want to do it, I've picked in my head a number between 1 and 10. And whoever gets closest to it, I can ask the question to first of how you got into punk. Or if there's, like, a natural way to do this that you guys have figured out, we can go with that.
No, we're not prepared.
All right, in that case.
Whatever you want.
Okay, pick a number, Alex.
Six.
I'm just kidding. Five.
It was five.
Oh, shit.
I was like, I don't know how to handle a tie. That's why I gave you that look of terror. I've never been in a tie situation. Okay, five. So, Hayden, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
I don't remember distinctly the first time I came across it, but I know that having three brothers, two of which are older, they started getting into, and we moved around a lot as kids, and when we sort of landed in Ottawa for an extended period of time, they were at the age of starting to go to shows or go to record shops and starting to meet people who were into different stuff, and so my brothers would bring home records that I had never heard, and we're all about 2 years apart, and so I was at this, you know, so influential age where I was like, this is really, it's interesting, it seems like very accepting, because, you know, as kids, when we're moving around a lot, it's hard to make friends, and it's hard to figure out what lane you're in, you know what I mean? It's kind of, your identity is kind of just floating for a lot of years, and so when that introduction to different records and different styles of music and stuff started coming through the door, I would get them to tape me stuff or to let me borrow their turntable and stuff, and eventually the first show I ever went to was at 5 Arlington in Ottawa, and it was to see Hoover.
Oh, wow.
That was my first show, my first live music experience ever, like you know, I've never been to like a big stadium show or anything. This was the first introduction to seeing people on a makeshift stage playing instruments together with songs they wrote themselves.
That explains a lot about you, I think.
Yeah, I'm still in love with that band, and just the approach to going to this makeshift place to house this type of experience was really just profound for me at that age. And so I just couldn't get enough at that point. I wanted to, I kind of didn't even really register like the bigger show type stuff, like we should go to a venue. I didn't really know what that word meant. You know, it was just a place where regardless of what walk of life you came from, you were accepted there. And this was a creative space where people were just really, really happy and seemed to be friendly to each other, even if they didn't know each other. And then, and of course, on top of that, there was an enormous amount of creativity coming out of, whether it's through music or zines or merch designs, poster stuff. It was just flooded with
vegan stews.
Yeah, recipes. Yeah. It was every art form was there, and it was, I just kind of fell in love with it, and I just it changed everything.
Well, it's interesting because, like Alex, you kind of hinted at there, your first concert experience is so formative. So, like, you know, seeing that giant stadium, so many people are like, oh, I saw that stadium. But so to see, like, a DIY concert and have that be the baseline for all music afterwards mm-hmm. is going to
yeah,
change.
Yeah, like a dirt floor and a band on Discord.
Yeah.
Who then, dare I say, like, your drumming style was very indebted to stuff like Hoover. Like, you know, when I first met you, I was like, this guy's got a style of playing that is not normal at all. And it was that kind of big beat, groovy kind of thing that you hear Regulator Watts, Hoover, Lungfish, different, like, you know, Discord.
Yeah, yeah. I never took any lessons for music and stuff. So I always kind of find this kinship between that introduction to music and like skateboarding, where I would try and visually emulate what I was seeing, and then just see, like, where do they put their feet here on the board, or how loose do they have their trucks, or where does he have his hi-hat set up, or where does, you know, where are they holding their sticks type of thing, like how much are they choking up, little things like that. And that kind of introduced me to, like, if it works for them, maybe I can find a way that it's comfortable for me. And that it evolved and changed over the years, obviously, but as an introduction, that was hugely formative, and it kind of just stuck with me for a long time.
It's interesting when you look at Ottawa punk in the 90s versus punk in the 90s anywhere else in Canada, because it's like, it's the closest thing there is to like a DC version of hardcore here.
Absolutely.
I guess before we get to that, Alex, how did you get into punk?
Remember the first time you came across it? Different, because I have brothers like Hayden, but they weren't leading the charge when it came to like finding new music and stuff. So I had a very suburban life, and there was no way for me to get into the city at that time. So it was pretty rare to get into the city. There was no buses or anything that would do that. There are now, but so college radio, huge for me. There were Carleton University and Ottawa University punk rock shows, hardcore shows, metal shows. And I would tune in religiously, you know, lying in bed, crank it up. I didn't tape them really, but I would just listen every week. And then, and it opened my eyes up to all this stuff that was out there that I didn't know. Like, other than that, you know, it was actually a great time for music, much music, too. Mm-hmm. Like, they would be playing East Coast indie rock, like, which, you know, punk adjacent, Murder Records, absolutely. You know, like, so that stuff got played on TV, which was insane when you think about it. So that was part of, that was like an entry as well. You know, you'd see stuff like Eric Strip or whatever. And but back to like college radio, that was like the first time I heard, you know, Bad Brains or something. And you go, what in God's name is that? And then when I did make my trips in, sometimes I'd go in, my dad would go to work in the morning, and I'd just go at like 7:30, and I'd spend the entire day downtown.
At the Reno Center?
Yeah, waiting for you'd have to wait for the record store to open. Yeah. And then I would spend the entire day at the record store until he finished at 5. That eventually got me a job at the record store. It's one of those, like, I was loitering so much. I was like, I had listened to every single album in the store. And they're like, we're doing inventory this weekend. Do you want to come in? And then I was like, yep. So I ended up working. That was Record Runner. I don't know if you ever knew that one.
Where was Record Runner?
On Rito. So no, down from the Rito Center.
Okay.
Yeah.
I went Rito Center. In the Rito Center in grade 9, we went on a school trip, and I went in there and I bought Mike Watt, Ball Hog Tugboat, mm-hmm. and Sonic Youth Goo as my first sort of like forays into punk CDs. So that is sacred punk ground to me. It's also, I'm going to say, in the top 10 list of the dodgiest neighborhoods in Canada that you don't want to hang out with.
It's gotten really bad now. It's kind of out of control now. It didn't seem that way then. You know, there was the Dom, where we would, you know, when I came of age, go, that was like, they'd have like a, what was it? Like a DRI tape that was like stuck in the thing. It never came out. Yeah. So you'd get a huge bottle of 50 and it would just be Glenn behind the bar and the same music every time. And you'd be like, this is great. And so that was a great spot. That was a great thing about Ottawa too. But back to the thing that you're talking about, Damon, about the DC style in Ottawa, it's got to be because of Scallon.
It's got to be Scallon.
It's Sean Scallon.
For sure.
It's Scallon, but then I'm thinking about it now, and it's like, I guess there's like a lot of similarities between Ottawa and DC. The fact that they're both kind of like, if you're not there working at one of the universities or in the government, you know, there's like a lot of people that work in these places. There's obviously a big transitory population of people coming in and then coming out at different times too.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Scallon, I guess it must be, cause he was like, even by the time we were playing shows there, I remember like we were playing a show, like obviously he did all our shows there, but he was like handing out an anti Supernova flyer because there was a Supernova show going on in the venue below the show he was doing for us upstairs, just telling kids like, there's a way to do this yourself. You don't have to let these people do this to you.
He was a huge influence on the entire scene, I think. Mm-hmm. He was, for people who don't know, he was, you know, a lot of the famous Fugazi photos were his. He was a big photographer.
Oh, he's like the Glennie Friedman of the mm-hmm. 90s. Like, you go through, like, issues of zines, and it's like, oh, all these Lifetime photos, all these, like, he's one of those guys that I think, especially now that people are getting more and more into that kind of era of music, his archives ridiculous.
Yeah. And he would book what he liked. And he'd book it at a place called Club Saw, which I went to 3-4 times a week. I know that's kind of pretty much where I met you.
Yeah.
I would just trust that it would be great. And it pretty much always was. It would be like, you know.
Yeah. He had his own label.
Tragedy.
Too,
like, who's this Tragedy band or whatever? Or who is the. And you'd just be like, every time, and you're like, okay, that was something I was not expecting, and it was great.
And I was thinking about this. There wasn't really an Epiphat kind of explosion in Ottawa. Like, I can't think of any local Epiphat type bands.
Muriel was booking stuff closer to that.
Okay.
So there was that, and they were bigger shows because at that time that stuff was like big business.
Oh yeah.
And it was not where we were coming from. Those weren't the shows that we would go sometimes, but the Club Saw shows were more what we were into, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was largely credited to Scallon, like you've been saying, in that he was this sort of heartfelt liaison to this outside world of, especially at, you know, going back to my first show being at Five Arlington and stuff like that. That was.
Did he do those shows?
I think he did.
That was his place, Five Arlington.
He lived there for a spell, and there was quite a few people that lived there at different periods, but he sort of opened that world to expand upon just exponentially, where you thought there must be a limit to this. There's only so many of these bands to go around. And it was quite the opposite. There were just, he would have connections with people all over the place. And regardless of the venue or the place that he could book it, he had his places that he would prefer, obviously, or had an in with. But he would just, it was kind of this beautiful thing that would just kept mushrooming into like, there's more of this out there. There's more and more and more. And it was really infectious to kind of witness that from the outside and then somehow find a way to sort of fake your way into it and start your own band and stuff.
Get on Bill.
Yeah, I mean, like, it was to see, to your point about the difference between big shows at big venues, big production value, big ticket prices, there's nothing wrong with that introduction to music at all. It just, my experience was the opposite in that that just seemed larger than life. It didn't seem achievable. And it's not to discredit the amount of talent or work that went into bands that would play at the venues we've been talking about, like Far Wellington and Club Saw, but it meant it was like there was a sort of like this, I don't want to use the word peer yet because I was still trying to figure it out on my own, but it seemed achievable. I've seen this person on the street before. I've seen them taking out their trash. I've seen them working a day job. If they can do it, you must just really want to do it. And so you didn't need to have any fancy gear. You didn't need to have access to a lot of really grandiose things. You know, you could figure this out with like drums that you got at a garage sale or just finding the right people who were just as enthusiastic. And that seemed like the biggest fire to kind of to grow on rather than like, how do I figure out how to get from here to there? Because that place seems like eons away from what I could ever achieve. But this is playing in a garage. It's absolutely packed. Everyone here is supporting each other. This seems like something I want to be a part of, but it also seems achievable. So
and the standard was set, yeah, like you're saying, at an achievable level. Like it was a Club Saw, no stage, maybe like a vocal PA, no bar, you know, no booze. It was like, and like what, $2?
Yeah.
It was just like, that was the vibe. Then it was set by people like Sean, and it just kind of became this, how things worked in that city, and it was great. It was a beautiful thing. There'd be, you know, there'd be shows in the park too. There'd be shows at the Sandy Hill Community Center and stuff like that.
And it always seemed just as important. Like it always seemed like no one was doing this and felt like it was an understudy to the big stuff. This was its own thing. It was just as valuable. It was just as, like, you never saw people kind of half-assing a show, whether they was putting on the show or helping, you know, load gear or sell merch or actually playing. No one was half-stepping. It was all like, this is hugely important to everyone here. And it just made it feel like there was nothing else in the world.
Very disconnected from any kind of music industry. It was definitely not even remotely connected.
Yeah.
And that was like, looking back, a very beautiful thing when it's just like its own microcosm, its own community, very much a community. I want to also, the Buried Inside guys, they were a huge part of welcoming me into that world too. Those were guys doing zines, doing house shows, doing radio shows, hosting them. Just wonderful people who were just like realizing that, you know, there's a kid probably at their first show, really nervous, doesn't know anyone. And Nick and Steve, those are the kind of people, Matthias, that would be like, hey man, what's up? Yeah. Come and check. Like, they'd welcome you in. And so there were people like that, really warm and really excited about this mysterious world of hardcore music that was, you know, you had to seek it out. And if you were there and you were in the same room, then they'd be like, well, you're obviously interested. And then they'd kind of usher you in. And they did that for me. They, you know, helped my first bands get shows and all that stuff.
I think and Matthias was actually the first hardcore road trip I went on. He was on.
Really?
And he was the coolest. So nice. So fucking awesome. And I think that, like you're saying, that does happen. But it's sometimes the exception and not the rule. Because there's a lot of people that cling to this thing because of insecurity.
Too cool.
Yeah, and like, it just becomes like, and gatekeepery is overused at this point, but it was very gatekeepery at times in hardcore.
Yeah, it's not to say that my or our experience was the same for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, I don't want to speak for everyone who may have not had that same kind of introduction to it or that welcoming approach, but for me at that time, it seemed very safe.
When it's also wild when you think about that period of time, and I know a lot of these bands probably shared some members, but the amount of incredible members, incredible bands that were coming out of Ottawa, like it's ridiculous. How many bands from, you know, obviously yourselves, Buried Inside, but like Godspeed You Black Emperor to Shotmaker to Okara, Speedy Huffler King, yeah, Okara. Yeah. Like there's just so much cool records, so many cool bands that came out of it. And it really did feel like there was like an Ottawa kind of sound at a certain point. And then there was, that was like the capital of punk and hardcore. Certainly like you're talking about DIY hardcore, yeah. like, there were other places that were putting out these sort of big pop punk bands around then. We certainly had a lot in Toronto. There were, Montreal had a bunch. Vancouver yeah. obviously had a bunch. But Ottawa was always like this sort of like real earnest DIY approach to things.
Yeah, it's about the ingredients, right? If you have a booker and then you have some bands that are cross-pollinating and you have maybe someone who's recording records, which I think that was still a bit of a mystery. There was no like local engineer that did everyone's albums that I can think of. It was sort of like, that was still, how do you do that?
that was definitely a bit of a mystery to tap into. I'm sure people got very creative about booking studios at like off hours when nobody wanted to work, so they'd get a discount or something. But yeah, that was, I certainly didn't have any technical ability on that front.
Well, it's not a music industry town. Like Toronto, there's like so many studios that are sitting empty, so many people that are just, you know, got a friend who records or something like that. Like, I can't imagine there's like a lot of recording studios, especially at that point.
Mm-hmm. Raven Street Studios, which I spent some time in, had sold a Studer tape machine to Albini. That was one of its, that was way back.
Yeah.
He was snatching them all up.
Yeah.
He wanted them for, so I remember they sold that to Albini. And, but now that I think of it, Tweedy from Buried Inside was someone who was recording other people's bands and out of Raven Street. And they also had like this, they had a recording school and all the students had to, for their final exam or whatever, record a band. And so I honestly think a lot of the Ottawa hardcore scene got their records recorded for free, like in an afternoon, by a student learning the trade. So it was like ragtag, yeah. to say the least. But like, all right, no charge. This is my final exam. Like, let's do
an EP. The original record reviews is a grade on your
yeah.
recording paper.
It also there's probably like a brain drain that happens too, where like, people move to Toronto, or especially at that time, Montreal was such a draw for people to move to because of the cheap rent. So I guess that's another thing that's happening too. Like people are great at recording or finding some sort of skill in the music industry and then move to a market which has, I guess, more money on offer or mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I think of Ottawa, I don't think of it being related to the music industry. There was no industry. It was like this circuit that you could, it was a stop on this circuit of touring. And luckily, because we had, you know, people who were willing to take the chance and book a band from like, I don't know, Kentucky or something to come through, and 50 people would come, then it just was this constant flood of great stuff that we could just pay $2 and go check out, and, you know, really inspiring.
But it's kind of off the touring circuit for like a bigger band. Like you could, you don't have to head north. You can just drive right to Montreal after the Toronto show.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's like something like Seattle or where like the music develops because, you know, you have to build it. Like Sean had to bring bands in. People had to bring those bands in to come play.
Yeah. No, he did. And even Almont had a scene, like, you know, all those, you know, all American football and all those yeah. emo bands that are big now, Jade Tree and Polyvinyl, all
yeah
that stuff was going through Almont like you wouldn't believe. And Almont, for people who, no one would know what Almont is, but it's like 40 minutes west of Ottawa. It is like a cute rural town where they shoot like Hallmark movies now because it's like adorable looking. But there was all these kids there who loved, you know, Captain Jazz.
Yeah.
And so those bands would go through and it would be like 400 people, and the bands would be like, that's the best show on our entire tour. And it, again, it's just an offshoot of what was happening in Ottawa, some other people going, I can do that. And so it just continues to spread, and it spread like west into this farm town.
That's
it
awesome.
It was really cool.
It was funny too, because like all over Southern Ontario, like it felt like there were a lot of towns that could support their own scene and had their own, like there, I guess there were enough kids post Nirvana explosion into this kind of music that you could have like an all ages show and get 300 kids from your high school.
You'd see it a lot in Quebec.
Quebec, definitely.
You could hit all these little towns that, you know, didn't really know of it, and they'd get the community center and 300, 400 people would show up.
Yeah, Epiphat music was like mainstream in Quebec.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, Reset became Simple Plan. Simple Plan, yeah. I guess, is the biggest outgrowth of that.
Right.
But yeah, like, I remember like Epitaph, one of the Epitaph comps was like charting in Quebec, and it felt like.
And it's still huge.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
Like, I think you think of bands like Lagwagon or something, they'll go, and the biggest show will be in Montreal.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because like, I wonder why. Like, why certain things clicked there. You know, Sweden too, like that sound in Sweden got huge.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's interesting how like geography affects that. And I guess it depends on like who the people are that are driving the scene, maybe encouraging it or getting a radio program.
Well, it's what we were talking about. It's why we like Fugazi and stuff, is because your first shows were like seeing Hoover and Drive Like Jehu.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's what your, the high bar is there. Mm-hmm. That's what you fall in love with right away. And I think that sticks a lot of the time.
It's also interesting because like the approach and why you did, and it's changed now because I think like everything's changed now, but like back then doing DIY punk was like this sort of like thankless task. Like this sort of like real, like you do this because you fucking love it. And the shows might not be a lot of people there. No one's making any money. You're probably going to be sleeping on the floor. But you're not doing it in service of, people are going to freak out about this thing on social media later on, or we're going to be able to advance our career this way. Like it's like a very Calvinist kind of like, you're doing it because you love the art.
Yeah. If we'd go to a show at Babylon, for me, it would be like a band like, I'm trying to think of some of those, a band like Against Me or something would like, or Strike Anywhere would pack out Babylon.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like outrageous. That was like a stadium.
Yeah.
I was like, what on earth? How, these guys are huge. They're rock stars.
Yeah. And great bands, but
that room holds how many people? But you know, you're
300 people, right?
Or yeah, 300 people. Yeah. Like, and you know, so it is this. It's just like this skewed scale of things. I thought that was unbelievable.
Yeah.
To see Sick of It All, that Babylon, and it's full. Yeah. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And now we play bigger rooms than that, and we're like, well, not all that impressed. Yeah. I'd like to play bigger rooms.
I love when you go back on YouTube and you can look at some of these shows that you were at. And you're like, wow, it was packed. And you're like, oh, no, it was a basement. There's 25 people in that basement. Of course it was packed. Like,
yeah, yeah. Your memory plays tricks on you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, like, as a young person, everything just seems so much bigger.
Yeah.
And you're just like, as you get older, you realize, oh, no, it's not. It's all smoke and mirrors. And I guess that's the other thing about DIY punk and hardcore is, like, you don't have any of those smoke and mirrors. Like, you get to see the people from the band loading the gear after the show. You get to talk to them. You realize, like, and it's interesting because, like, I guess going from what you went to where you had never seen another concert to going from, like, going from that stadium show to a DIY show, it's almost like you're like, oh, my gosh, it can be done a different way. Like, it is sort of like the blinders coming off because there's so much edifice involved in music and there's so much bullshit fakeness to make this seem effortless and cool and always fun.
I think the DIY thing for me made it feel more important than maybe even it was. Like, it felt like life and death. Like, it was like this commitment to this thing that no one else understands.
Yeah.
You know, it felt it was our little secret or something. And I know that sounds a bit weird, but it's what it felt like. It felt pure and like with really good intention. Like yeah. this thing full of, is this really positive? And actually, like, there was this just overarching positivity to the scene there. Like, there was like a hardcore sports league. Yeah. Like, people were just wanting to hang out and wanting to, like, share this, their lives together in this way. But we were kids. So it was like, baseball game on Sunday. And, like, the whole, you know, all the people you'd see at the gigs would now be playing baseball. And then they'd go get a burger at Lick's. When there, it was yeah. just like this very...
For sure. It connected
scene.
It did feel very, again, from our perspective, a privileged perspective, it seemed very welcoming, very inclusive. And it felt like there was a lack of, I'm going to use the word fear in a very loose term, but like when we booked a couple of our last tours with Three Penny Opera, like we were booking out of that the encyclopedia, which was Book Your Own Fucking Life.
Book Your Own Fucking Life.
And
you got it?
Right there.
Talk about sort of lack of fear in terms of like, those are people's personal phone numbers in that thing.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
It's like, yeah. there was a trust that you would like, no one's going to misuse this or yeah. like, and we would call on one of the other guys in the bands. We would rack up this enormous long distance phone bill trying to book this thing. And it seemed like the most important thing in the world. And you'd play art galleries, coffee shops, some, every now and again, it'd be a venue with like a PA that actually lived at the venue, didn't get like carted in for the show. And that took us all around the country, like 6 weeks worth of, six weeks worth of connections that we found in a book and called on payphones or from home phones. And somehow we got from one city to the next and didn't make much money. In fact, I think we either paid or came out maybe like flat at the end and broke even. But that type of like, is the van going to make it? It's like, I don't know, but we're still going to go.
Yeah.
Is your gear going to break? Like, I don't know, but we're still going to go. You know what I mean? Like, it was just this, and maybe that was part of the stage of life that people were at when that was important. Maybe it was, like we've been describing, this genuine enthusiasm about building this up from nothing and not asking anyone's permission to do it. It was all those factors. It was this cocktail of all those things that made it special. But for those things to all work just seems like an impossibility, and somehow they did. Those dots always connected, and it was just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think that also there was this moment where there was like this idea that like, sort of like, I guess, crass notion that you could divorce yourself from society, and we could have like a punk rock economy where you go to DIY shows, you go to the organic grocery store, you go to the vegetarian restaurant, and it's all punks, and it's all like, we're all like in this together, and it's sort of a separate thing, and it's really ideal. But it did feel kind of tangible when you're like looking at Book Your Own Fucking Life, and you're like, oh, there is this network of people that you can kind of tap into, and it is growing.
Yeah, it's like a tradition that was evolving.
Yeah,
because you know, you had the Black Flags putting the groundwork in, you know, making those connections, and then it's spreading out like a virus.
And you also had people that were in the scene, but also had a different persona outside the scene. Not maybe not persona, but they were into different things outside of that, and they would have their own string connections. Where, you know, we did like a session at Stanford University for this radio show because one of the people there was heavily into the scene around San Francisco. I wouldn't have thought that those things could exist at the same time. And so you'd have people who, you know, were, I'm exaggerating a bit, but, you know, lawyers by day, and they would go to shows at night. So that it did sort of spread into all different avenues that it wasn't this isolated thing. It was constantly just stretching out into all these different territories. So like, you kind of got a peek at something special, but it could sort of coexist at the same time.
We also had more compartmentalized lives back then. Mm. Like, your hobbies weren't your persona, and you... So, like, not that punk is necessarily just, like, a hobby, but, like, you wouldn't necessarily have to share that with people. I think now, because of the publicness of life, everyone knows your interests, and we talk about our interests a lot more, but back then, it's like, oh, no one here was fucking understand what I'm doing. I'm not gonna tell the rest of the people at work about this. Like,
yeah.
This is my world, and... And I guess the other thing that's kind of happened was there was almost this great flattening that came where now we're all kind of part of the same economy, especially when it comes to music, in terms of like there are independent labels, and there is a difference obviously still, but like at the same time, we're all on Spotify, we're all part of these corporations that would have been the thing we were all trying to avoid. We weren't allowed to have a UPC on your record back then.
Yeah, there was no interest, and as you know, this, I'm sure this has been talked about a lot on your show, but you know, that notion of not getting involved with the industry and it being frowned upon. Now, like, that doesn't exist. I don't think younger generations, I think they just see someone who doesn't get involved with those things as a failure. Like, mm-hmm. as a bona fide failure. Like, what do you mean you don't have a million streams on, and you're not, you know, dancing on TikTok? What do you mean? Like, that's, you got to do that. That's, like, the thing. And that it was so far removed from where our heads were. Obviously, those things didn't exist, but the idea of getting in bed with a major label or something, it was alien. And I mean, I'm not saying if I don't give a damn about, you know, sellout. That's a silly thing, like that notion. But it really was like couldn't be more alien than.
I think it's still, like, looking at some of the bands that have done sort of big moves that in another era would have been the death knell for your band. They still get blowback, but you're right, like, it's not, like, what it once was. Like, I always bring up, Jello Biafra got his legs broken because someone perceived him of selling out at the Gilman. Like, there was a real anger and fear and resentment towards people that were, like, trying to make those moves. But, yeah, now it's just all part of the game in a way. Like,
I guess, to that point, I guess one of the things we've sort of neglected to mention is that for all the good things, there can definitely be a darker side to stuff where, this thing, people can also get very protective about things that is special to them and maybe don't have the best way of dealing with that when it starts to grow or starts to be shared in a way that they're not comfortable with. So, you know, it was great for us, but not everyone looks at it the same way or, you know, wants the same outcome.
Well, and I guess, like, you know, when we talk about Ottawa, like, we're saying all this positive stuff, very Anakin Skywalker to Darth Vader, like, one of the most evil things to come out of punk rock comes out of that Ottawa punk scene in the form of Gavin McGinnis.
Mm.
And he's at those Five Arlington shows, too. Like, he's in a band with the dude from Godspeed You Black Emperor, Anal Chinook.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He was a guitar player. What's his name? I'm blanking on his name. And Gavin was the vocalist. And they were like an anarchist.
I remember that name. I mean, how could you forget that name?
Yeah. I first read it about
never heard the music.
Vice did an article, like 90s Vice, about the best punk bands in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Anal Chinook was one of them. And that was the first time I had read that name. Little did I know years later how much infamy that would
hold.
Man, I did not know.
This is the wildest thing I got when they threw us out of the practice space next door. A guy's like, hey, do you want all these tapes we found? And this is the Bionic promo tape that they did, you know, Jonathan Cummins' band.
Yeah.
But on SSG Records, Shane Sarouche, Gavin Records, before they did Vice Records.
I mean, look at, that's a great layout right there.
It's a killer. Like, this is why, this is the company that built a $1 billion empire.
Right. Jesus. There. Jonathan was always a big supporter of Mets. He would write about us in the Montreal
Mirror,
right? Like a couple different publications.
Too,
he'd come to the shows and kind of like, you know, support and also tease us. and then like DJ. You know, I remember I have a lot of good memories of him DJing an awesome night after one of our shows or something, like, and just being like, I love this guy.
Oh, he's
awesome. I love the Doughboys, too.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever seen the Doughboys? It's like a Much Music Spring Break set, and the Doughboys are playing in Jamaica, and everyone's sitting on the ground. And you can tell he just fucking hates it, and then he throws his guitar.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen that.
Oh, it's awesome.
It's good stuff.
It's classic for YouTube. Well, like you said earlier, back then, Much Music had cool shows on. Like, there was Rhapsody, there's The Wedge, Pepsi Power Hour into the Pepsi Power Half Hour, whatever. And then you had Going Coastal and New Music. Like, there was so many weird opportunities for stuff to get on.
You could find so much great stuff. And I was glued to it. Like, you know, after school, it was just like, that's what you do.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of garbage on there, too. But I it was a great resource.
It was a really cool resource because I felt like it was still producer driven enough at that point that if a producer found something interesting, they were going to do a story on it. Like, there's a bunch of fucking Goofs mini documentary that they did for the New Music way back when because the producer was like, oh, this is cool, let's do something about this.
They you know, there were music lovers at the station, and they were getting some, they were able to choose clearly. You know, it wasn't a playlist that they had to stick to at that time.
But it's interesting when you look at the scenes in Canada, especially in punk and hardcore, that produced some of the most important bands from that era. They're the scenes that weren't at all covered by much music, like Winnipeg and Ottawa. You've got Going Coastal covering the coasts. You've got Music Plus covering Quebec. Obviously, much music's here in Toronto, so stuff's kind of getting on there and things like that. But yeah, like...
True.
It's the rest of Canada that's kind of like left in the dark at that point. And but because of that, scenes got incredible.
Yeah.
And different motivations too.
Winnipeg was always a good stop. Like, it was always, it felt a bit like Ottawa too, in some of the politics and some of the, I don't know, just the vibe, what was it? The Albert?
Yeah.
Across the Mondragon.
Mm-hmm. And was it Black Rose Bookstore? Remember the Propaganda had like a cafe and an anarchist bookstore there at one point?
Yeah, or maybe... that was in a restaurant.
Yeah, in a restaurant, yeah.
I thought it was like Mondragon or something. What, I have my,
I don't know.
I can't remember. Not,
I'll have to text Chris Hanna and get the correction on this part. Right? But you're right. I didn't even think about that, but there are a lot of similarities in the DIY hardcore scene to Ottawa in the idea that this is like... And it's not like this was a career scene necessarily, and there were definitely DIY bands in all these places that were doing it, but it wasn't like, there wasn't the upward mobility necessarily, at least from an outsider's perspective, and from what you guys have said, in Ottawa and in Winnipeg, that there is in Toronto for a band. Like, I think that's why there's so many new wave bands and metal bands from Toronto and less hardcore bands, is because, like, why would I waste my time in a hardcore band when I can get on much music?
You can't get on the radio.
Can't get on the radio doing this shit.
So, like I said, for us, it was like, if you could play Babylon, that would be more than you could ever hope for. You know, I think, and all we, you know, when Hayden and I got together, it was when The Gray was crumbling. And... I guess I'll tell that story. Yeah. I think that's kind of, that's the beginning of this band. So after Three Penny Opera, you started The Gray. And did some touring and had a European tour booked. And I had just started to get to know you. I think we had sort of chatted about doing something other, like doing something else, but it hadn't really started because you were busy.
Yeah.
And... But anyway, right before the tour, a member of The Gray kind of just for personal reasons, like, I'm not coming. Can't do it. And, but the, you know, like we just said, booking a tour like that is a lot of work. And so you were like, well, I'm going. I'm not.
Yeah, it was the first time we would have gone to Europe for a tour as well. First time. So it was
for Penny Opera never went?
No.
Oh, okay. Wow.
No. It had been discussed a few times, but it never materialized. And then, so when this one did, I was like, it's probably going to be the last thing we do anyway, so I'll let people know that that member is not going to be there, but we're still going to do it. And there's, yeah, sure. So Alex stepped up and did guitar and some vocals and stuff, and then pretty much on that tour, we had started discussing doing something when we got back, because we knew that was going to be the last venture for that band, and started doing some stuff, sort of just piecing it together. And that was kind of also the last, I think we also knew that was going to be our last year or two in Ottawa, and wanted to just change things up. So when we moved to Toronto and we met Chris, and I knew Chris a little bit from before, and it was just, the chemistry was right away. So it was like, this is actually the start of the band. And that was where it kind of took off.
Did you got to see Three Penny Opera, Alex?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, several times.
They felt like they were... I felt like you guys were going to be huge. Like, it really did feel like this is the band that... Because, like, it was post-Chokehold, pre, I guess, Grade kind of blowing up. And there was, like, this sort of moment where it's like, oh, they're you guys were so fucking good. I know you probably... hear this all the time, but like
never
really.
No, it's been so long
I
ago.
Think the I first know. Time I saw you guys was a Hardcore Hotline benefit show. It was a matinee at Club Shanghai.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think Riot 99 might have played too.
I have a terrible memory with some of the venues and who else played and stuff. I was just sort of in awe, just absorbing it all. Obviously not very well, but my memory doesn't serve me well.
It felt like also because like Shotmaker was such a storied band, and it's like, okay, this is the next chapter in this thing. But also at that point, like, it's not like Sub Pop and Matador and Merge were signing hardcore bands or seemingly bands from, I don't know, what I thought was the underground back then. So like, where would you go? Like, I guess Revelation would have been something. Like, where would you like...
Yeah, Jade Tree was kind of touching, like...
A little bit, but they had moved on to, like, post-Lifetime to kind of more, kind of, like, poppier stuff, it felt like, or...
Polyvinyl was on the radar, but they were, like, a totally different label than now. When I was out in the suburbs before finding the downtown scene, it was, like, Heart Attack, Mail Order, Ebullition. Like, Read the Review, Ebullition... Mail Order with my friend Aaron, who he, you know, and so you'd get your Orchid 7-inch at the mailbox kiosk, go home, and it was so much fun. It was really exciting. It's like, do I like Ink and Dagger? It's like, I think I do. And it was just like, you would trust these writers or not. And these little blurbs about what they sounded like, and you would check the label. Labels were very important.
Label,
like,
hugely important.
The record label, that is. Like, yeah, it's like, I like most of the stuff this label puts out. Okay, I'll get this. And it was the only way to get it.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, going to your store and asking them to order it.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, talking to people for this podcast, like, how many people just didn't sign to the right label. And you think back to these bands, you're like, they are as good as any band from this thing. Mm-hmm. But because, yeah, like as a kid, if it said Lookout, I knew it was going to sound like this. Yeah. And if it said Fat, I knew it was going to be like this. And it was like, it was almost like that brand equality you needed to take a chance on something. It was so label driven back then.
Yep.
And there were no, I guess Initial was kind of like you said, Ink and Dagger, like Initial felt like that was like. I felt like it was like trying to be the Sub Pop of the hardcore world for a
Interesting.
Moment.
Yeah. Who was on like Guilt?
Guilt, and then Enkindles, Ink and Dagger, Metro Shifter.
What was the really good... Elliot.
Elliot. Elliot was on Rev, cool. And then went to Initial afterwards, right?
I think so. I think they had something.
They had the first records on Revelation.
Oh, right.
I remember that. But it was just because it was like such a break. Well, Revelation at that point, I guess, didn't really have a sound. They were
I thought of them as the... Tough Guy Hardcore, like the Gorilla Biscuits, and I mean, it's not tough.
But no, but I know what you're saying, like more traditional, fast
80s hardcore. Yeah.
But by that point, but they had Kiss Goodbye by then, Will Haven, like even they were felt like they were kind of like going to.
And like Sensefield and stuff.
Sensefield, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, that was what's cool about it too, when if your friend had a radio show, they'd play like some metalcore stuff, and then an outrageously poppy song by Elliot or something. Yeah. But it all lived together based on not sound, but like world outlook or something. Or like it was tied together through these labels and through these scenes. But they didn't sound anything alike.
If you gave one label a stamp of approval from another, you could play it on the same show. Like you could play something from Great American Sacred Religion and the next song would be on like DeSoto or Slowdime or something like that, where it was like almost jazzy but still within that scene. So as long as you had this collective sort of not approval, but you know, propping up of different avenues, it's like this is still all cut from the same cloth. It's just like you said, it's sort of like some of it is like ethos driven. as long as it had that stamp of approval, it could definitely coexist.
And it wasn't even like world outlook driven, like you're saying. It's like almost like as long as it was part of punk, as long as it was part of this thing, because like the politics sometimes would be wildly divisive between bands in the same scenes, right? And like, but yet it was maybe to a problematic level at times, like still all accepted because it was all, well, we're all punk, so we can all kind of exist within this little society.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't without its flaws.
The bills were really diverse. I mean, that's touching on the exact same thing. But, you know, you see, like, the plan with Tristezza, which was basically, like, sounding like Sigur Rós or something. Yeah, but, like, in a squat. And with a, then the next band is a grind band or something. And it's, like, all made sense somehow because, you know.
Yeah, well, like, even, like, even that Hardcore Hotline benefit, none of you guys sounded the same, but you're all coming, you guys probably drove the furthest from Ottawa, but like you're all coming to do a benefit for this phone number that people call to find out about shows. And it's like, why do you do this? It's like, because it's what we do. It's just like part of the thing we do.
Yeah. I didn't really have a concept of labels or getting big or anything. It's, I mean, that's not to sound like, it just didn't really occur that often when you're just in it. It's like, we have a show next week, great. Or there's another one, or there's a tour coming up, or, you know, summertime is coming. That means that summertime was always tour season because everyone's in school.
Yeah.
And I remember I got permission to write my exams early one year so we could head out on tour. And it was kind of the best because I got I just wrote them by myself in the library in like this little room so we could leave on like this big tour. And it was great. It was memorable, but I didn't really, there was just an immediacy to it that I didn't really look that far down the line.
Yeah, but I think the immediacy to it also, like, in a different way, because it was ex-Shotmaker, it felt like, from a fan perspective, that there was hype around this band immediately. Like, the 7-inch came out on Spectrasonic, right? Like, there was, like, and obviously this is all relatively speaking, like not major hype, but then versus Metz where you guys like built the fucking band from the ground up. And not to say that like you weren't slogging it out in Three Penny Opera, but I feel like there was already a tension on Three Penny Opera, at least
It was definitely a different kind of approach to doing things in general. I don't mean it in a negative way, but in Three Penny Opera sometimes I felt like I was just tagging along. You know, there was this thing. Yeah, I think the last tour we ever did was in 1999. And so my math is terrible. So I would have been 20 years old.
Yeah.
So for the majority of that band, I was still in my late teens. So I had no real perspective on that kind of stuff. I was just like, I'm driving around in a van and I get to play drums every night and people somehow know it, and I appreciate the people behind the scenes that make sure that they know about it because they're distributing records or they're, you know, putting on shows. I just didn't really think about it.
Well, that's the thing. I always say Metz is the hardest working band from here that I know, because you guys had that band from the U.S. for so long.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you're not doing it for, because post Death From Above, Broken Social Scene, like all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, there is upward mobility in Canadian music in some way.
That's true.
Yeah.
And you guys were here just slogging it out, going to Europe obviously as well, but like a lot of like the Canadian music industry is built toward getting across the border and trying to do that thing. So by the time you guys did, like you've been, like no wonder you guys were so shit hot by the
that
time.
That was
you got
one
down
of those interesting, like, you know, it just worked out well. We weren't able to go anywhere, so we stayed basically in Toronto, and we played Parts and Labor basement, and like really were able to see something grow. It was kind of wild, and I still look back on it with pride, because it was like those shows were wild, and they were starting to, like, the lines were starting to go down the street and wrap around the building and stuff. Like, there was, like, word of mouth, real thing happening, which was really fun. And then
It gave us time to figure out what we were trying to do as well, and, yeah. and not be distracted by not reaching too far, but just, you know, stretching ourselves too thin.
So, the bullshit that kind of comes with, like, and it's obviously, like, you guys are in a great place label-wise, and all have your heads on pretty straight, but at the same time, like, the amount of fuckery that kind of happens once you enter that world, like, the amount of cliche drugs being put in front of your band, like, all sorts of weird shit, like...
Mm-hmm. Getting but remember, so this is another good thing. This all happened when we were pretty damn old. We were not... When Metz started to kick off...
It didn't stop. The age didn't stop a lot of people back then, as we all know.
But I will say that I think if we had been in our 20s... We were in our 30s when Metz started doing anything of note. And if I was in the 20s and we got to tour the world, like, endlessly and stuff, I think it could have gone pretty poorly. Mm-hmm. I'm just speaking for myself. Mm-hmm. But we were kind of through that part of our lives. I know I was, like, so it was, we were very serious about what we were doing, and, you know, and then we got interest from a label that we all loved that just kind of pushed us into a new realm as far as opportunities go, you know, being able to really being able to do it full time. That was, like, because of Sub Pop, obviously, and because of the response to that first LP, which went kind of crazy.
But had you guys met them before you were able to go to the US, or was it after you guys were able to start crossing again? Because I guess they had signed the Constantines.
Yes.
Around that period.
Yes. I don't...
I'm sure there's some sort of
connection. We met, like, Mark Arm in Toronto.
Yeah.
And he kind of...
Did you guys open for them at North by Northeast, or, like, Canadian Music Week or something? They played the Horseshoe?
It was the Horseshoe.
Yeah, that was an awesome
He was
show.
Like a liaison into us getting signed, from what I know. He's kind of tight-lipped about it, actually. But I think he kind of gave it the seal of approval after that show at the Horseshoe. Yeah. If you're thinking about signing them, maybe you should.
Out of any celebrity obviously being to us, he's the one that I still kind of get weirdly starstruck around. I'm always like, oh shit, Mark Arm, because I think about 1991, the year Punk broke, and his parts in that, and I'm like, damn, like, Grohl, all the rest of them, it's like, well, whatever, but Mark Arm, man, like,
yeah,
Green River.
I think of him as the I hope this isn't offensive to him, but he's the blueprint of the grunge guy. It's not Kurt. I think it's him. I think he made the style. I think it was sort of like his look.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah.
The chucks and the plaid and the.
Yeah. It's interesting when you look at, like, the histories of scenes and things like that. But, like, if things had gone the way they were supposed to go, Mudhoney would have been the Nirvana.
Right.
And that's the way it looked like. I'm sure that's the way it probably felt like when you're in the scene at the time, and it's like interesting when you talk to people that were in, like, explosions like that when it happened. They're like, yeah, I never thought I was gonna be that band. I thought I was gonna be this band over here, and like, they're I love Green River. I go back and listen to, like, Green River stuff all the time. I'm like, this is
Hayden's been known to rock that t-shirt.
Yeah, I think it's riddled with holes now. I wore it so much.
The thing you realize with we've been fortunate to meet some of our musical favorites, you know, and him being one of them, and Rick Froberg being one of them, and John Reese being one of them, like, people that made a mark on us as, like, changed the way you think about music and the way you play your instrument, like, that kind of stuff. And to meet those people and them to be the most down-to-earth, cool people is, like, I think it affected us in the way we try to act as a band, you know, like, that makes a huge difference. Like, you introduced us to Bob Mould, same thing. Like,
really?
When he played at the Phoenix, and that's the first time I met him.
Oh, I thought you met him before that. Yeah. Oh, that's right. You knew Jason, though.
Yeah.
You're super tight with Jason.
Yes.
Okay.
So that stuff's just amazing when it's just like, man, you know.
And, well, like you were saying, like, that to me is what this is about. And, like, not to say it's, like, it's about star fucking, but at the same time,
totally not.
It's about meeting your heroes and have them become peers. So you are now a part of this thing that was so special when you got into it. And, like, that's the currency. Like, it's not going to get be getting famous, because some of the greatest punk bands, like Rock of the Tombs, like they didn't even have a fucking record that ever came out when they were around, but they were like one of the most important bands ever.
Yeah.
And so that's being part of this is what the reward is, because it might not be financial.
Yeah, you know? I do feel that sort of getting that feedback from the people that influenced you and it being them being like fans of what you do is the peak. Like it's better than any kind of write up in a magazine. It's like it is, and it's not like that was never the end goal. It was not you're not trying to do that, but it is sort of the highest compliment I think you can get.
Mark Arm telling Sub Pop Records that they should sign you, like that's fucking like fuck a Juno, fuck a Grammy. Like that's like way higher of an achievement to me. Like to I don't know. That's just like why I find this so rewarding is that these people are still a part of it and still it's something that you carry with you your whole life. And
yeah, it's easy to become a lifer when it is validating at various important stages of your life or your musical career, if you want to call it that. And you know that there are speed bumps along the way and things change and people change and, you know, not everyone was a, like you mentioned, not everyone was a saint coming out of that scene. There's some pieces of garbage that can still roam the planet claiming that they came from the same scene type thing. But in our experience, every person that we've met, like I remember mowing my parents' lawn, listening to Group Sounds, The Rock from the Crypt. And that was, I believe that was the first one that Mario played drums on.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I remember mowing my parents' lawn. It's like, this lawn is not big enough, because I would just like, I wanted to just keep doing it. And the fact that several years later, by happenstance, but it's not. It's because of these connections that we've been describing this whole time. It's like it's because of that that we just crossed paths. And now we're very close with John and Mario and we're
John's
with Rick.
Like, come record. I'll book some studio time. We're like, are you out of your mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. It's amazing to meet people that you revered for so long and have them be exactly, if not better, than you expected. I think it's a testament to the good side of the stuff we've been describing, and I wouldn't change that.
Well, like in that perfect timeline we're talking about where Mudhoney is Nirvana, Rock from the Crypt's Blink-182. Like, there's no way it's, you know, like, why isn't this band? Like,
yeah.
I remember, did you see them? Did you guys go to the London Warped Tour when they played at the London Warped? They had played, I think, Toronto before that, or done a Canadian tour before that.
I only went to
one Warped Tour. It was in Montreal.
Okay, this was like...
Never again.
This was the second one. And it was like NoFX, Fishbone, Pennywise. So bands that were great live, you know, like Fishbone, like great bands live.
Yeah.
They wiped the floor with everyone. Like they came out there and it was like, holy shit, this is a Vegas review.
Yeah. One of the best ever. As far as like, he changes up when Rocket takes the stage, like he turns into another person. It's really something to behold.
It's like pro wrestling style. Like he goes into kayfabe mode.
It's a persona. Maybe the funniest one-liners you can imagine for like a show. Like,
yeah,
just you're in stitches, and then you're also blown away by the tunes and the tightness, and you're like, wow. Yeah. It is like a review, like you're saying.
And that's why I love this, is because like at one time, it's Fugazi up there taking it super seriously, being super fucking earnest. And then at the same time, it's Rock from the Crypt, like putting on like a James Brown level stage show.
Yeah.
And then it's also Riot 99 or something else. Like it could be like so many different things, but they're all.
And that all could have been the same show, like we were talking about. Like it was, you know, depending on the venue, that could have been the same billing, which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also was like, you know, you're talking about those bands that were like trying to do the Sigur Rós type thing back then.
Mm-hmm.
There were bands like lugging cellos and like woodwind instruments in the back of a van too, and then lugging into
like
a basement.
Godspeed would play Club Saw, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then Born Dead Icons would play the next night, or
yeah,
just like so diverse and exciting.
Born Dead Icons are one of the best fucking bands from that era. Holy God, those LPs are sick to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, it's wild. Like there was, it was like this great moment. It felt like too, in independent underground music here. Where there was just like a lot of stuff happening where all these bands were like popping off, playing small venues still, and it was like because in the '90s, it even though things were, it still felt very contained, with the exception, I guess, of Ottawa. But by the 2000s, man, it was killer.
Mm-hmm.
We were going for it. Did you guys ever? After that ban, did you know about the ban before the ban started? Like, was that something you kind of were like, hey, we can't go to the U.S. for a while?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, I guess I'm extremely an anxious person, so if I don't clarify what this was about before I walk out of here.
It's a positive ban. It's not a negative ban.
Yeah, yeah, it was, there was just some, we didn't have a proper work visa with a different band, and they're just like, you can't come in, you didn't do the right thing. It was like, so that was our mistake, and they just they turned us around for a few years, so we couldn't do it. But nothing nefarious, nothing that hasn't been corrected since, and we do everything by the book now. We can't dare not.
So I think it happened to a lot of Canadian bands, and it was like the death knell for a lot of Canadian bands.
Yeah, it was shocking, and it was before Metz was even a seedling, kind of, and it was disappointing. But yeah, it was nothing sketchy. It was just like, you don't have the right paperwork. And that was, and then there was a bunch of forms that were stamped, and then it took a few years before we were allowed to cross. But, you know, ever since, obviously, we do everything by the letter. But it's, so we did know about that at the beginning of the band, and thankfully, Chris and Alex were gracious enough.
We kept them around.
They were gracious enough to be like, we can work through this. You know, I think there was a good 3 years by the time we started. There's still a good 3 years left on it.
We used to roll.
I think it was more than that, I thought.
Well, the whole thing was 5 years.
Yeah. It felt like.
But by the time Metz was starting to do stuff, I think there was 3 years or so left on that. Because we were focusing on, obviously, just Canada for a while.
I remember towards the end of it, people were starting to ask me about you guys in the States. What's the deal with that band Metz? And then I'm like, oh, they can't come down for a little bit. And like, but it was like already the sort of like hype was beginning to kind of spread. I guess it was a blog era too, right? So you didn't necessarily need to tour to get your name out in that sort of way.
We by the time it was, I remember we all drove up to Niagara Falls because we used to like, you know, as all bands begin, you do everything together. It's like everything's so exciting. So the day that it was like the day the band ends, the three of us drove up to Niagara Falls to go to the border. Hayden goes to the border, comes back with the, and we're like, yeah! Like, so now we can go tour the States. Like, it was like hilarious. Like, we have photos from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
that was a joyous day.
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Because it really, it's interesting too. Because, like, I think back in the 90s, there was like this idea, like, okay, you can be a band and you can just tour Canada forever. But, like, that is a brutal tour.
Yeah. It's a hard stretch. And I think the States, especially on the, I mean, coming from Ottawa or Toronto, the eastern states, you can get to a new city with like, you know, a 3 or 4 hour drive tops, as opposed to in Canada where it's like 8+ hours a day. So it was, and we knew lots of people from different scenes and previous bands and stuff that we knew we would be in good company. So we had, you know, these sort of connections or kinships with people that we couldn't really, not take advantage of, but you know, use in an effective way.
Well, Chris had a lot of connections because he'd been doing
for sure. Yeah. So that was all huge for us too, and it was a relief to know that we could sort of just spread this thing that we wanted to do and tap into different scenes in different cities that we hadn't been able to before. And it felt, I mean, I think the first couple times you do that, it feels like this. Feels like luxury. You're in a different country, even though you're, you know, it's still connected.
But I'm trying to think of what those first tours were. Do you remember who?
I can't remember. I don't think they were long stretches. I think the first few times were like these little jaunts, but
did you guys do South by Southwest early on when you guys just got over the ban too?
We didn't.
Let's stop talking about this ban, okay?
No. The band. Sorry. The hiccup.
Yeah, hiccup. I like that.
I think the first time we did South by Southwest, we already had the record out.
Okay.
And
I think so.
And the hype was kind of ridiculously large. It was, I like to think of those things as like there was a time when CMJ and South By were like, they're just like a press gauntlet. Like, it's sort of like, who's going to get the most headlines, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like this sort of competitive thing. And it's like, that year when our record came out, it's like, you know, I played tons of shows at both of those industry festivals, and it was just overwhelming the amount of coverage we were getting. Shocking. Like, you know, if there was a winner of South by Southwest press, it was us. We just, people wouldn't shut up about it, and it was, felt great. Of course, you're like, wow. But like day and night, from it just kind of happened, boom, the record came out, and everyone wanted to write about us or something, or cover the record, which is beautiful.
Yeah, this is the only time to me that...
You can understand this, too. You had this happen.
It was the only time that I was like, oh, this makes sense. Like, if you go down here and you put in the work, and you play a bunch of shows, and you just go fucking hard at all these shows, everyone's here, and everyone's eyeballs are on you. And I think, looking back on it, it was such a golden time. I know it's post-Napster, but for, like, independent music, quote-unquote, because people weren't necessarily streaming, but there were so many media outlets writing about bands.
Yeah.
And now, where there's less and less of these outlets, you realize how essential they are to the kind of the ecosystem to be like, no, pay attention.
They're starting to dwindle. I mean, that being said, I gotta say, like, our record's about to come out, and we've been blessed, like, so busy with press for this rollout, and it's, you know, we're super thankful that that's still happening, you know, on our fifth LP.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's amazing still, but definitely there aren't as many outlets.
And it feels like, they're like, maybe there's more because there's like podcasts now and there's, you know, like individual people doing their own thing. But like at that point, The Enemy, like Vice, Pitchfork, like Brooklyn Vegan, Sterigum, obviously those two are still there. But like all these things that, like we're talking about earlier, we're not necessarily paying attention to bands that were starting out, like bands that even had underground hype, like Three Penny Opera. Like, they weren't necessarily being written up in these sorts of publications, but now they were focusing on bands.
I think of us as a remedy to the 12-person band that was the thing. Like, it seemed like our timing was it was welcomed because it was like power trio. There's not a violin in sight. It was just, I really think timing has a lot to do with it for every band.
Every band, yeah.
So for us, it was like we were this remedy to something that was maybe getting a bit stale.
Yeah.
And the timing was right. And we had the push from Sub Pop, who I've always, from that first record onward, have just been like, you know, super supportive of whatever we wanted to do, whatever way we wanted to take the new music was like they were behind it.
Yeah, I think having like a label that supports what you're doing and believes in it is I don't know, it makes so much difference to like why you're just someone else validating it, being like no, you're doing something good, like keep at it.
Yeah.
And it used to be like Heart Attack reviews at a different time. Were those first 7 inches reviewed in Heart Attack? Was Heart Attack gone by that point?
I don't think we were touched.
Yeah, you would have been, but it must have been gone by that point. As like a,
I don't recall.
I mean, that's the thing too, right? It's I always feel that we've lived outside of genre. I've never felt we had a lane. Well, we've always had our own lane, but I've never felt we've fit in with anything. So you go from obscurity to Sub Pop. So then, obviously, the punk zines don't want anything to do with you if you're on Sub Pop. It's too big. And then before that, I don't know, maybe musically we weren't, those early 7 inches are a bit weird. Like they're a bit experimental, I'd say.
Yeah, and it was kind of just before genre really started breaking down again in punk and hardcore. Like genre was so key for a while. Like we were talking about those labels earlier, like, oh, this is the Youth Crew label. This is the Silkscreen Towel. A paper towel cover record label, or this is this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, it kind of was like, this is just music. And if it's good, it's good. And if it's not, it's not. And
now it feels like we're back to genre because of streaming. It's like vibe-based. How are you going to get on this playlist? And Lord knows we don't fit on any playlist, you know.
Yeah.
The coffee shop thing or whatever. Like, it's once again, sort of, we're just on the periphery of whatever is.
I feel like both of our bands really benefited from that era where you had people being like writing long form reviews. Mm-hmm. And like, obviously people still do, but like where everyone was reading these long form reviews and
they had impact.
They had impact
at that time.
Huge impact.
Yeah.
Like
it would correlate with ticket sales and record sales.
Oh, and getting on festivals.
Yeah.
Like, and I found it still like, once in a while, someone will be like, oh, send me a new record. Like a friend. And I'll be like, oh yeah, sure. Send it to them. And then you don't hear anything back. And then the Pitchfork review drops and they write you like, hey, love the new record. Like, you had it for months. And it's, but so it these things still have impact. But at that time, it felt like you're saying, like you could make your whole career by going down to a CMJ and just fucking killing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, like, that's your career. Like, I really feel like there's just moments where in Fucked Up's life where I'm like, wow, like, that's what made it. If that didn't happen,
yeah,
it would
Mike wrote a thing recently
about South by Southwest. Yeah,
yeah, and how like he was being very honest about it. How I was like, yeah, that changed our career's trajectory, or you know, I forget what moment it was, but like, or it was a review or something. That stuff's true. Like, it's you can't deny that and try to pretend it didn't happen. Like, for you know, for both of our bands, I think that we got pushed forward, whereas, and it's like we said, there's some fluke, there's some timing, there's some deserved
mm-hmm.
stuff as well. It's not all, like, but it's just this thing that you can't fabricate it. It kind of was something that just either happens or doesn't.
Yeah, like you work
can't
really
make
hard.
Make it happen, you know.
Yeah, you work really hard to get the luck.
Yeah,
like you're like it's all luck and timing, but like. It's not to undercut the fact that before that South by Southwest, you guys had spent 3 years playing like Sarnia and local shows. And
I used to
really
think luck was a bad term too, but I don't think it is. It's just it's an important part of life. And there is, you know, I know people say you create your own luck sort of thing. I don't know. I don't know if I can refute that or debate it, but I think it's more effective to acknowledge that does play into it, and that you do have an active role in that to some extent, and it totally gets factored in, because we could all probably list 10 bands that work the asses off and it just doesn't click at the right time. It's no comment on talent or work. It's just it's timing, it's luck, it's, you know, the climate, it's a variety of things.
Yeah, like, not to undercut the songwriters that developed out of this band, but like, what's the difference between Grade and Alexis on Fire in the beginning, but like a few years, like sonically, like they're both kind of like doing the same thing as young kids, but Alexis on Fire, like that clicked and obviously developed into something
massive.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
It's wild.
Yeah.
Like, it's also wild, like, when you think about the peers around us at that time and just like, you're talking about playing Parts and Labor. There's no bigger star that's come out of like our world than Matty Matheson.
True. Mm-hmm.
Like,
very true.
It's like arguably one of the biggest food stars in the post Anthony Bourdain era. Like, what, Guy Fieri
just won some Emmys?
Yeah, just won a bunch of Emmys. Those guys don't have Emmys for dramas and stuff like that.
And what a beautiful ambassador for this city. Like, that guy is, you know, deserves all the praise. He's been very supportive on a lot of fronts, and yeah, I'm really happy to see all that.
I really feel like that's someone I watched grow. If you look at Matty Parts and Labor era, or maybe just like pre-Parts and Labor era, like, that guy is not the dude.
No, it's
still
amazing.
Still personality-wise.
Personal
wise.
Growth.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's so cool to see.
It's applaudable, yeah.
It's like, and it's also like, we're all kind of like from this like scene where we're going to basement shows, obviously spread out over Southern Ontario, but that's like the one commonality between all of us.
I mean, Matty was like a huge supporter of our band. He'd cook us food before our gigs, and then we'd go down to the basement and we'd all, you know, have a crazy night. And and that built those nights really built the reputation of the band. They're in his venue, and he was there every time.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so, Maddie, yeah. Thank you.
Yes, like, truly. He was great to us.
Or putting that venue in that restaurant. I remember when the reviews came out, and everyone's like, fucking shitting on the fact that, like, oh, there's loud music playing as I'm trying to eat my food, about, you know, and they did that, like, to have a space to do shows. And that's at a time when there weren't. There
was no, they saw the importance of it.
Yeah.
Which was... They easily could have just shut that down.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a testament to the background that people are having in within that art and music scene, where it's like it's important to them, enough to them to factor that in into other steps and other stages. And just the term space, you know, it is there a space for the show? We're not, like, it's sort of indicative of how, like, anything will do if we can make it work. It can be a basement, community center, venue, coffee shop. It's just a space. So you just need a vessel for this thing, and we will take it from there. And you can always tell when someone came from that background, because they always factored into new plans, because it's still that important to them. And, you know, and Parts and Labor and Maddie was a great representation of that. And I, you know, we love him for it. That's amazing.
It's almost like that was like the Vice cocaine era update on the DIY model, where you play a floor show in someone's basement and they cook you food before you play. But it's like super nice. The food's incredible.
The food was fucking fantastic.
Food was fucking amazing.
It was so good.
But he would always do, like, I'm like, oh yeah, man, I'm going to have, like, Terror and Power Trip down. We're going to cook food and they're going to go to the basement doing some show thing. And it's like, wow, you don't have to do this, but you do it because it's part of the culture that you came up in. And that's,
yeah, he kept doing it when he had Wu-Tang come with Maddie Fest. We played that too. Like, it was just like, what's going on? You just saw this thing grow. By the way, that's a really good Maddie impression.
I've spent a lot of time with him over the years working on it. I have a few impressions that I keep in my back pocket, but that's finally one. Most of the ones people have never heard of, most of the people I can do impressions of, but Maddie's one that at least people know. I was filming that wrestling TV show I did, like, 2018, and I'm in this neighborhood, neighborhood in Atlanta, with all these kids at this big family barbecue that one of the wrestlers had, and one of the kids comes up to me, he's like, hey, you work for Vice? And I'm like, yeah. Do you know Maddie Matheson? I'm like, it blew my, this is like way pre-Emmy Bear Maddie Matheson, but still, like, he was famous at that, I guess, but it was just like, holy fuck, how do you know Maddie Matheson? Have you heard of this dude?
That rules.
And, but yeah, and like, we all kind of like did it. You know, like, I think for Fucked Up, my favorite tour ever is, like, us and you guys and Tyson Dronicus in England that time. That was such a fucking amazing tour.
Absolutely.
And to be on tour, like, with all these people that are just like, yeah, fuck, we just did this band because...
There's something beautiful to making something out of nothing.
And when it's, like, anti-careerist and it winds up happening, too. And,
Yeah, there's, you know... It is, when you listen to the music we've made over the years, it's clear that our intentions were to do something that we loved, and it was not to please someone else. And I think when that also ends up pleasing someone else, you know, enough to call it a career, to call it like a full-time thing, that's kind of a really lucky thing, because we had all these notions of what a good song is or what a good sounding, and it certainly isn't the industry standard, you know. It was, if anything, the opposite of it, and it still sometimes blows my mind that we're still doing it and still sort of not pandering or compromising on what the vision of this band was. You know, we want to be successful, but we're not willing to kind of change what brought us all together. And that goes full circle to, you know, how we all started and how we all fell in love with this thing.
Well, you guys gotta get to band practice.
We do.
But yes. Anytime you want to come back on here separately or together and talk about any of this shit, you guys are always welcome to come to my smelly basement.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hayden and Alex, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, anytime those guys want to come back on,
on a tour together, whatever they want to do. I love hanging out with those guys. So hopefully it will not take years and years and years for them to come back on the show. And hopefully Chris comes back soon, too. All right. Coming up on the next episode, it's a it's one of the punk rock bowling episodes, and it's a good one. From the band Stiff Little Fingers, Jake Burns is on the podcast. And this is why I do this podcast, to find out information like you'll hear on the next episode about scenes that I've been obsessed with for a very long time. And I'm not going to ramble on anymore about it. You're going to hear it very soon. Well, that's it for this episode. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. Stop hate and violence toward people of different faiths, different identities, different nationalities, different races. Because we're not talking about politics. This is just basic human rights shit. Ceasefires aren't politics. They're just basic human rights. People deserve to be able to live free from hate and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations in your community that are affecting positive change in this world and you think you should be involved, get involved. I'm sure they would appreciate your time. If you have spare money, I'm sure there's money that could be donated as well. Speaking about getting involved, though, speaking of getting involved, get involved in punk, start a band, start a fanzine, start a label, start a podcast. But you know, it gets better when you contribute to it. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And try meditating. I talked about it, I think, on the last intro, but I'm in a lot of pain right now with this leg injury, and meditation's really helping. Doing some deep breathing right now just to get through this extra. Well, that's it for me, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.
It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out of this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turned Out of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening. And you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front. And everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there. Because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.